Welcome to a well-turned anchor, the life, times, and dreams of one man, Thomas Carter. Episode 1. The passage was cramped and dark. Space enough for one, but no room for elbows or a misshapen ankle. The heat was oppressive, and he wasn't sure if he was heading in the right direction. He slowly dragged himself along, all the while aware of his uncomfortable ankle, which appeared to be at right angles to his leg. In the distance, somewhere towards a thin slither of light, he could hear muffled screams and the occasional profanity. Heavy breathing echoed along the passageway, wafting the odious odour of lavender deeper into the cramped tunnel. Slowly, using what little strength he had, he clawed and scratched his way along the oppressive tunnel, searching for hope and light. His ankle hideously disfigured, his elbows searching for room. What kind of life would he have? His eyes shut tight against the light, he knew he must somehow drag himself towards hope and maybe relief. As he drew nearer to the dim brightness, he heard someone singing. But before he had time to register what tune it could be, he was wrenched forward, foot pointing skyward, and wrapped in a grubby towel. He was born. The midwife slapped him several times, for no obvious reason, and his foot aimed for the sky, twisted and spurned by the rest of his body. The infant, a mix of all the right parts, but not all facing in the right direction, was beautiful, if a little grumpy, and had entered the world at a time of great change and upheaval. The ankle belonged to Thomas Carter. He was the fourth son of Thomas and Doris Carter. Choice, the candy floss for the indecisive. Too much makes them sick. Choice, the dairy product eaten by black country mice. Choice, a luxury the Carters could ill afford and would not have for many years. Faced with a foot that had a severe case of misdirection, Thomas had no choice in footwear and socks for many years. What he did have were two parents and several siblings, all eager to gob at his errant foot. Strapping him to her one good arm, Doris wrapped baby Thomas in a freshly laundered sock and prayed that this child would one day achieve very little. She wasn't an ambitious woman. Thomas Sr., a tall and powerful man, could only hope his latest offspring didn't have any plans to run before he could walk. Doris had always dreamt of a half-timbered kitchen with wattle and daub supplementing the mould and disease. Her roots were dim and loose, and she had very few discernible motherly instincts. She could recognise poorly appointed limbs and had suffered with ill-fitting elbows as a child. Thomas Sr. had served with anonymity in a top-secret stables miles from the Western Front, feeding equines lies and straw in equal measure. The baby faced many years of struggle and hardship, and it was hoped that his misaligned foot would not hinder his journey through life. Doris was something of a celebrity in housemaid circles, having been voted Housemaid of the Year for 3 consecutive years before she met and married Thomas Sr. As a teenage girl, fresh out of housemaid college, she had quickly found employment in a rather run-down home belonging to a gruff wool merchant. The gentleman in question, Horace Weave, was married to a much younger woman, Nancy O'Doodle, the daughter of a wealthy wire magnate. They were an unlikely couple, at times impressive, known as a wire-wool couple. They had a small circle, They were an unlikely couple, at times abrasive, known as the wire-wool couple. They had a very small social circle. Despite their age differences and his extremely poor personal hygiene, they had gone on to have 8 children, 4 boys and some girls, and somehow rubbed along without too many bumps in the road. Doris was nervous when she first started employment with the Weaves, but soon became an integral part of the household. Her abilities as a housemaid were almost instinctive, and she would later contribute articles to the Bible of Domestic Service, Housemaid's Knee, a cornucopia of trivia, facts, and interesting articles, all aimed at the housemaid or her knee. Thomas kept several copies of these, and I'd like to share them with you. Housemaid's Knee, Essential Reading for the Busy Housemaid, Issue 3, Spring 1908. Problem page with Dear Prudence. Ask Prudent Flax, the doyen of dusting, the monarch of muck, and friend to the unwashed. Prudence is always on hand to give helpful advice to aspiring housemaids and enthusiastic masters and ladies of the house. Dear Prudence, my late husband Chester sadly died a few months ago, and I am at my wit's end. Our housemaid Molly has tried very hard to remove by now his rotting corpse, but I fear she will be unable to move his fetid remains. She's only a slip of a girl, and if she tries to lift him, he was a very large man, I fear she may do herself a mischief. Can you suggest any ways that she might improve her lifting abilities? I understand she had rickets as a child, so her legs are a little on the bandy side, and she is riddled with consumption. She is, however, very enthusiastic and wants to see the back of Chester as much as I do. Can you help Molly become less of a weakling? Dear Florence, housemaids can be so brittle, and it's no surprise to hear Molly is unable to remove the remains of your much-loved husband, Chester. If I were you, I would purchase, as a matter of urgency, a pulley and some strong twine or rope, and perhaps Molly could fashion a primitive contraption to lower your husband out of the bedroom window. Obviously, she'll need to pull a finger out and start eating a sensible diet, rather than that stodge she rams into her scrawny throat most evenings. She could acquire a lifting girdle, and suggest she wear that in tandem with some sturdy boots. Obviously, you cannot be expected to pay for all this equipment, so perhaps you could deduct the cost from Molly's pitiful wage. Strong housemaids are so difficult to find, and your situation is replicated across the country, thanks to poor diet and health of the housemaid. The government needs to act, otherwise gentlefolk will have to do their own bloody dirty work. Yours, Prudence. Dear Prudence, my husband insists on bringing his pet llama into the drawing room to entertain the children in the evening. Whilst I do not mind a llama, he does defecate on a regular basis, and the smell has brought my two daughters out in hives. When I suggested to my housemaid, Sissy, that she should attempt to house-train the llama, she said, and I quote,
"It's a damn liberty, your ladyship, and that's no mistake. That llama is the devil."
Whilst I appreciate that the underclass have a very primitive understanding of evolution and wildlife, to suggest that the llama is to blame for the smell, while Sissy does nothing, is an affront to common decency. Should I have Sissy arrested? Dearest Lady Camilla, I sympathise with your horrendous dilemma. In the old days, it would be nothing to clean up llama faeces, but housemaids of the current crop seem to think they are above llama shit. If Sissy continues with this obstinate behaviour, I will be inclined to dock her wages for 6 months and make her share a room with a llama. Quite often, tough love is the only way to make the underclass see reason. Yours, Prudence. Dear Prudence, my housemaid, David, insists that he should be allowed to dress as a man if the fancy takes him. I have nothing against men per se, but I was under the impression she was a woman. Imagine my shock when he arrived in the drawing room, dressed as a man, with a hideous beard and the overwhelming whiff of masculinity. When she first came for the job, she insisted that she was a mother of two with experience of dusting the larger cobwebs. Now, all David wants to do is prance around in his gentleman's clothes and pass snide comments about the butler, who is also a lady. Yours, Lillian. Dearest Lillian, what a pickle you find yourself in. I can only imagine the vapour attacks you must be suffering at the moment. If I were in charge of the hiring of housemaids, I would insist on David sticking to being a gentleman when not at work, but reverting to a housemaid attire during the daylight hours. Perhaps a new cap with laced-edged Guildford Swiss frills would help David feel more wanted as a housemaid. I would also suggest that abundance of ribbons and a nice apron will make David feel like a new housemaid. David needs to understand that her services as a housemaid are appreciated and that you respect his feelings and need to dress as a gentleman. If this doesn't work, contact the police and have the fucker arrested. Yours, Prudence. Doris worked in several households, and it was during her time with the Weaver family that she won her first Housemaid of the Year award, the so-called Dusty. It was a complete surprise, as she believed herself to be unsuited to the cut and thrust of domestic duties. Indeed, it was such a shock that she felt overwhelmed with the accolade and left to start a new position in the wilds of Hull, employed by the Platt family in their vast house which overlooked Hull's premier fish-gutting works. The Platts were well known in and around Hull as a family who had never opened their windows and always seemed to have a cat in tow. Hector Platt had made his fortune in the ribbon importation business and was known as a man who could tie ribbons in knots. He started his business after his father ran off with a burly milkmaid and left his family destitute. Young Hector hawked his ribbons in the seedy haberdasheries that littered the waterfront of Hull's docks. Often foregoing the more exuberant colours, Hector's lamentable selection of ribbons were often worn by sad sailors and sombre seamstresses. As sure as a well-tied ribbon will bring a smile to any face, Hector's business expanded, and soon he was importing ribbon from exotic ribbon plantations in far-off lands. He was the first man to sell yellow ribbons outside a public house, and a plaque commemorating the transaction can still be defaced outside the Skipping Inn, a rough and tumble boozer of the old school. Blue and red were soon added to his portfolio of ribbon colours, and his wares were in high demand. When he made his first million from ribbon sales, he purchased Dunn Fishing, a sprawling edifice to fish and the aroma of fishing. Needing a housemaid with partially inactive nasal receptors, Doris was taken on immediately, with special responsibility for making the horrid whiff of the fish seem less oppressive. Compared with the waves, the Platts were childless, thanks to poor breeding. So Doris spent most of her days with a sturdy feather duster, wafting away some of the more urgent smells. When not wafting, she polished the cup and saucer that was used by the Platts and ensured that any stray cats that found their way into the house never left without a gaily coloured ribbon adorning their neck. Doris was unfamiliar with both cats and ribbons, but she proved to be a natural knotter and could decorate a tabby without breaking a sweat. This dedication to the Platts saw her nominated for her second Dusty, and at the ceremony held at the prestigious Dustmite Retreat Hotel on the outskirts of Hull, she was the housemaid who's dusted the most. An acceptance speech given to an audience of housemaids and parlourmaids is still viewed as a shining example in self-deprecation, with a smattering of insight and wisdom for any budding duster or servant. Her acceptance speech. Walking from room to room, armed with only a feather duster and a head full of suspicion, the housemaid's lot is a lonely existence. Battling away at the fringes of society, at war with dust, lint, and that perennial bugbear, soot, the housemaid must always be on her guard. One careless flick of the duster could send insignificant quantities of dust onto an unsuspecting master who could, under certain circumstances, die. Lonely is the housemaid who has accidentally crushed the skull of their master following a vigorous dusting of a priceless porcelain pot. Anxious is the housemaid as she effortlessly glides from room to room, rounding up lint and storing it away for the winter. Woe betide the housemaid who is profligate with lint. Yet the life of a housemaid doesn't need to be fraught with danger and jeopardy. If a Persian rug is inexplicably covered in excrement, there is a solution. If the bone china tea set is smashed to smithereens following an impromptu cushion fight, it can be replaced. If you feel like strangling the lady of the house because she is a stuck-up toff with no manners and the grace of a torpid turd, it shouldn't mean you have to throttle her with nickel elastic. The housemaid is cool and controlled when faced with life-or-death household emergencies. As a young girl, the notion that I would win one Dusty seemed incredible. But to win two is beyond my wildest dreams. Of course, they will need dusting, so it's not all fun and games.
As I stand here, dusty held tight and bonnet set at a jaunty angle, I am reminded of my 14th day at the Platts, when Mrs. Platt was struggling with a severe case of the vapours. Much as I wanted to purchase a backbone and tell her to stop being such a weak sapling, I restrained my natural urge to gently tap her on the noggin with a ladle. Instead, I lightly dusted her and confined her to bed for a while. The following day, the vapours had disappeared and the lump on her head was not as obvious. In years to come, when boffins in white coats have eradicated dust, housemaids will seem like a prehistoric anomaly, viewed with distrust and disdain in equal measure. But until that dawn, let us celebrate dust and its infinite capacity to get fucking everywhere. Thank you.
Doris continued as a housemaid of distinction up until the birth of her third child, Thomas, when she finally hung up a duster and devoted her time to a dust-filled hovel and her children. Thomas had never dusted and refused to countenance dusting during daylight. Parents of such a powerful influence in Thomas Jr. never once thought that dust was a problem. In fact, he cultivated dust and stored it in safe places all around the house. When Doris died in the mid-1940s, Thomas inherited his mother's prized duster, which was covered in dust, and two of her three dusties also found their way into Thomas's possession. In the next episode, we'll be looking at Thomas Sr. and the lengths he went to earn money. So catch that next time if you enjoy this one. Thank you.